Good morning. You're all very, very welcome. Dervin McDonald with you this morning. Hope you are keeping warm wherever you are. Our newspaper panel have been sorting the best from the rest in this morning's papers. But before I introduce them to you, let's have a quick look at what is making the headlines this morning. It will come as no surprise to you that there is one story dominating the world's newspapers this Sunday. And that is, of course, the capture of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and his wife, Celia Flores, and their rendition from Caracas to New York, where they are set to face charges of alleged narco-terrorism. The declaration by US President Donald Trump that the US is now running Venezuela and that its biggest oil companies will take over the world's largest reputed oil reserves is carried in all of today's titles, both Irish and international. Trump, I now run Venezuela, that's the lead story for the Irish Mail on Sunday, accompanied by an image of Maduro with large glasses and headphones clutching a bottle of water as he is transported to the US. That image is widely covered on the front page of many of today's papers, including the Sunday Independent, which leads with a report by Wayne O'Connor that families of residents in nursing homes are being warned that new rent reforms due to be introduced in March could prevent them from maximising the value of inherited properties if they let them to tenants. The new rules, which are aimed at giving greater protection to tenants, will allow tenants to remain in situ for 6 years, a move that some property experts predict could devalue a home by up to 30% if it is sold with an existing tenant. The Sunday World splashes with a report by Patrick O'Connell that the intended target of a horrific New Year's Eve arson attack in Finglas in Dublin has been at the centre of a bitter feud over the past 6 months. An innocent family were subjected to a near-fatal arson attack following a campaign of petrol bombing, stabbing and car ramming involving the intended target. That's according to the Sunday World. We'll run Venezuela, vows US after capture of Maduro. That's the lead for the Sunday Times. It comes as the United Nations has warned that events in Caracas has set a dangerous precedent. Trump fear factor, US firms scrap Irish jobs announcements. That's the lead story for the Business Post. The lead is based on remarks by IDA chairman Fergal O'Rourke, who says that US firms are increasingly fearful of announcing significant investments here in light of Donald Trump's aggressive America First industrial policy. We're taking the oil out of the country is the lead for the Irish Sunday Mirror, which, like the Sunday Telegraph and the Observer newspapers in the UK, also features that arresting image of a handcuffed and blindfolded Nicolas Maduro aboard the US Iwo Jima amphibious assault ship. Mr. Maduro is expected to make an initial appearance in Manhattan Federal Court tomorrow. Well, looking over all of those titles, and with me in studio are Josepha Madigan, former Fine Gael Government Minister, Scott Lucas, Professor of US and International Politics at UCD's Clinton Institute, Liz Carolyn, publisher of thebriefing.ie, and Pat Leahy, political editor of the Irish Times. You're all very, very welcome.
Thank you so much.
Scott, that image is priceless. Just aboard the assault ship after they'd been captured from a safe house. That is, I think, going to probably be set to be one of the iconic images of the year.
Yeah, but I think there's a risk here that's precisely what the Trump folks will want in terms of this boy's own narrative of this daring raid to capture Maduro, to deflect from, I think, what are the really serious issues, beginning with issues for Venezuelans who face uncertainty and instability now. But just to give you the quick synopsis of what's happening here, hard cases make bad law. And so I think we could probably all agree that the Maduro regime, the very repressive regime that many people detained unjustly, many people threatened unjustly,
many killed.
It's the economy has been run into the ground. More than 10% of the population, more than 3 million people are refugees in the past few years. But what took place over the weekend was a flagrant breaking of the international law and the international system. You have gone into a sovereign country. You have kidnapped their leader, even if it was an unjust election, their leader with military force to put him on trial back in the United States on what are charges that at this point have very little support and evidence. We'll see how that plays out. And it is for a combination of motives that are effectively 19th century colonialism on steroids. There are the personal motives of Donald Trump and his advisors like J.D. Vance or Pete Hegseth to be the tough guys, to be the guys that can rule the world under the Donroe Doctrine. There is the motive of oil, because through all the nonsense and all the rambling that Trump, and he did not look well in yesterday's press conference, he put it on the table. we have gone in to run Venezuela, and we are taking Venezuela's oil. There is the motive of regime change in Venezuela being pushed by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. And there's this fundamental which came out in their national security strategy a couple weeks ago, which is, they call it the Trump corollary to the Monroe Doctrine, which is we effectively run the Western Hemisphere. And I can tell you this has gotten so serious, not because we like Maduro, but because of what's happening around the world. I did interviews yesterday with people on international outlets who were honestly saying, could the U.S. do the same thing to Greenland, even though that is part of Denmark, an ally? And on Canada's CBC last night, their flagship station, getting asked by a host how much farther could they go, you know, and realizing she wasn't joking about whether they could send military forces into Canada because of Trump's threat to make it the 51st state and because Canada has a lot of oil.
Yeah, and it is, I mean, Venezuela home, I think it's just something like 303 billion barrels of oil. Was there a sense, Scott, that maybe that he had to do something? There had been such a build-up in terms of, you know, the US military might that had been sent to the region in advance. You know, I can't see any circumstances in which that fleet would have politely turned around and went back.
Oh, yeah. I mean, he had to pull the trigger. You've had 10 warships off the coast of Venezuela. You've got 15,000 troops that have been mobilized. You've got F-35 fighter jets that are positioned. I was anticipating, because he let the cat out of the bag, that the CIA had attacked ports a few weeks ago. I was anticipating bombing of military targets. I was not anticipating they would abduct Maduro. That was the part that surprised me. But I think that raises a wider question here as we go into the uncertainty today. Because remember, Trump has declared we're going to run Venezuela, even though the government is still in place. Maduro's gone. But the vice president's become acting president, Delcy Rodriguez. General Lopez, pretty much a strong man, is still there as defense minister. The foreign minister is still there. Now, there is a theory running around, oh, they're going to make them comply with America. They'll cooperate with America now, whatever that means. But if they continue to resist American demands to hand over their oil industry, or if they continue to resist American demands to leave power, what does Trump do next? Because the paradox is, this was the man who supposedly was not going to get U.S. involved in foreign interventions. And now it was a man who said yesterday, well, what's wrong with boots on the ground?
And it's interesting, Scott, because, you know, what happens the day after? And is there a risk that the easiest part was going in and capturing Maduro?
That's always the case. And I mean, might as well say it, but, you know, although a different part of the world, a different time, Iraq 2003 is going to rear its ugly head here in terms of what you do when you remove a leader. And then you have scrambling for power, you have insurgency, you have people fighting each other. Now, I think at this point, the Trump plan is to either make this government comply. I think that may be their number one option. But then it's to find an opposition leader that they'll promote. But you can't just parachute in an opposition leader, even if some people really want change, because that opposition leader will be seen as a puppet of the United States. If I was to say keep eyes open, everybody's looking at Maria Machado.
But Trump came out last night and said she's not respected.
She's not respectful. But Eduardo Gonzalez, who probably won last year's election, she is the person, Machado has said, bring Eduardo Gonzalez back, because he is in exile as well. Bring Gonzalez back so he could become the leader of the country. But again, unless the Venezuelan military decides to roll over, that's not going to happen easily.
Yeah. Liz, the United States has a long interventionist history in that region, and not all of it entirely successful. In a sense, there is a risk for Trump, because he now owns the outcomes, and a civil war or another mass migration, because already there have been so many people who have fled Venezuela, he will have to own that outcome too.
He will, and he's likely, you know, kind of shopping around for who's going to be loyal. Like, this feels a little bit like when the mob boss takes somebody from the neighbourhood out and shoots them publicly to kind of make everyone else fall in line, right? Not necessarily to do with that one individual. You know, and the Make America Great Again thing, you know, like Trump was very explicit in the national security strategy that this is going back to the 19th century Monroe Doctrine, which was
now calling the Don Row.
The Don Row, I know, eye roll. But like, it's that was explicitly a colonial doctrine. It was about, I have my sphere, you have your sphere.
And that was the original Monroe Doctrine, I think, back into the 1820s, wasn't it? About this hemispheric influence, and that basically certain world powers would have their own part of the world that they would.
Yeah, and he was very explicit in the national security strategy. And this is a vision of the world which is kind of rejecting the post-World War II international rules-based order and is saying, OK, we're going to have a couple of big cheeses around the world, you know, China, Russia, maybe India and the US. We're going to have our spheres. We're going to leave each other alone. Where does that leave Europe is the question, right? We're seeing that thinking, you know, applied to Ukraine and the sort of willingness that Trump has to effectively cede Ukraine to Russia, because he's like, well, Russia's the big guy over there. That's his sphere of influence. If I give him that, then I'm over here. Where does that leave the EU? Where does that leave us? It's an extremely worrying turn of events. And it is just, you know, he's saying what he's doing. And in that same national security strategy, he was also talking about supporting far right groups in Europe and explicit attacks on European institutions. You know, he's calling it around kind of censorship or speech governance and all the rest of it. And again, over the kind of Christmas period, we saw revoking of visas of, you know, senior European officials, of activists in my field from the US for doing disinformation research, right, for trying to kind of regulate. So it is, you know, he's doing exactly what he says he's going to do.
And to see from that again, you know, the United Nations, the European Union, you know, all of the post-World War II international rules-based order, it seems to have absolutely no role.
Yeah,
in any of this.
And you know, I found it extraordinary yesterday when I saw him being interviewed, and he said that, you know, this was an extraordinary, stunning, spectacular, and then yet in the same breath he's saying it's dark and deadly. This isn't the first time this has happened. Of course, we had Noriega in 1989 under the Bush administration being removed from Canada. So there is a precedent for it. But in terms of international law, you know, effectively this is an act of war. We are removing a head of state. The US force is doing that. The UN Charter of Principles, it's illegal. So it's a really worrying turn of events, as Liz said. And I do think, as Scott also alluded to, in terms of oil, you know, my understanding is that 70% of the oil that is coming into America is crude oil, and a large proportion of that is based in Venezuela and Canada, as Scott mentioned, but also, I understand, Russia. One wonders what Trump's game plan is here. What I find most disturbing is when he talks about being a peacemaker, but a peace with strength.
Peace through war.
Which is sort of a quagmire of, or a paradox of a phrase. And while he's talking about Ukraine being a bloodbath, in the same breath, he is invading a country, effectively, taking over a country, removing its head of state, regardless, as Scott quite correctly said, of our views of Maduro and his regime, which are questionable at minimum. But he's doing this at a time when the world is so fragile. And it seems to me he's almost removing responsibility because he's saying he inherited Ukraine and Russia. In other words, it's sort of not my war. And now he's turned the focus to Venezuela. So it's very concerning. And I think we really, you know, the EU has obviously going to monitor this very closely. I know Heather McEntee was on to the, you know, the UN, you know, foreign ministers about this, but it is something that we're going to have to watch closely. I understand, obviously, that there were hostile relations between the US and Venezuela for a long period of time. But I think as a country, we always have to put international law first and the UN Charter principles.
Pat Leahy, you had spotted a piece, I think it was in the Sunday Times, Mark Urban had a piece. I know it's probably still a little bit too early in the initial shock and awe phase for analysis to get their heads around it, but he had a piece, America gambles in another fray into its backyard, but this is regime change light. Do you agree?
Yeah, I mean, I have sympathy for newspaper analysts who, having long since filed their pieces before Christmas for this weekend's edition, were suddenly scrambled like the Delta Force themselves. The analysts were scrambled yesterday morning when our phones all pinged. With this news. I think, as Scott says, the question is always what next. And I mean, there's some good reporting this morning, and also in some online sources. But there's also a kind of a dearth of information as to what is actually going on the ground in Venezuela. Who is in charge? Are there U.S. military troops still there? Exerting control. None of that seems to me.
And no
from
definition of what running
clear.
Venezuela looks.
No,
or sounds
and I, that seems to me like one of those things that Trump just says because he's asked a question, and it may or may not be backed by a thought out post decapitation plan. Presumably, somebody somewhere has a day two plan, but it's just not clear what that is yet. And I think, you know, there's some mention of the EU, and you know, the other panelists have described the world as it is now, the world that Trump has wrought and continues to make. And that's all true, I suppose, for the EU. For Ireland, the question is, how do you react to that? And I think what you see in the EU reaction, I mean, there's no doubt that all EU governments will be completely horrified by this, because they can see it's a breach of international law, but more importantly, it is a statement of what the de facto new international law is, which is that, you know, large states with powerful militaries will act unilaterally in furtherance of what they see as their interests, where the EU fits into that. So I think what you're looking at the EU reaction is now, and that they are, despite what I've no doubt is their private horror about it, they're not actually verbalising that, because Ukraine is a greater priority for them now. And US support to end the war in Ukraine in terms or on terms that guarantee Ukraine's ability to continue as a sovereign independent state, which is what Putin wants to avoid, and that's the most important thing for the EU now. So they will swallow their criticisms, I think, or they'll swallow their horror at Trump's actions here in order to pursue that goal.
Yeah, it's might is right politics. And like, you know, I believe the Trump administration when they say we don't want to do interventions, we don't want to be taking over countries. He wants deals and he wants power. And if, you know, the vice president of Venezuela, he's, you know, they're currently out saying, you know, oh, this is terrible and Maduro will be back and all the rest of it. There is no loyalty in a Maduro-style regime, right? There is power and there is very real politics. If Trump can do a good deal with the existing regime, keep it in place, get the oil, have his power, that won't help the Venezuelan people, right?
But where does it end then? I mean, because he was talking about Cuba, he was talking about Colombia, you know, so, you know, and somebody mentioned Greenland as well earlier on, you know, so we just don't know when he's going to stop. And, it, you know, he's you know, to a certain extent, sometimes criticises Putin, sometimes doesn't, depending on his mood, or Zelensky. But he's doing exactly what Putin's doing. And, you know, it's concerning.
Can I ask you, Scott, it'll be interesting when the stock markets open tomorrow. There's only one US oil company, Chevron, who are still in Venezuela. But of course, if you look at, you know, stuff that Stephen Miller is putting out, they're just basically saying all of this was stolen from us. We used to have more companies there. You never paid reparations. The companies have been quite quiet themselves, but presumably they were consulted in advance. But even now, we don't know what role they are going to play in reviving and or controlling the Venezuelan oil sector.
But they weren't consulted. See, that's the key. When even Congress wasn't consulted, congressional leaders, about what's going to happen. And the question here is, which way does the oil industry go? First of all, it's very useful you actually mentioned, because the myth is out there when Trump says they stole this industry from us. They didn't. Chevron is involved as part of the industry. And the reason why Chevron's relatively limited in terms of what it brings out from Venezuela, it's not because of Venezuela restrictions. It's because of U.S. restrictions, because of sanctions. Now, what the oil companies, while they would like to get back into the Venezuelan market, other oil companies beyond Chevron, is they would want stability in an oil market. You do not get stability in an oil market when you have political uncertainty of the kind that we're talking about here. Because all options are here. It could be that they may support an opposition leader to come in, although it's interesting the distancing from Machado. It may be they try to strike a deal with now the acting President Rodriguez. It could be a military coup, in that the military under General Lopez comes in and seizes power in Caracas. So when the markets open on Monday, you're going to see a lot of caution because they don't know which way this will break.
Getting a bit of pushback from some of our listeners. Dan in Cork says there has never, ever been peace that was not achieved through strength. Only force of arms can secure peace. A lesson that Europe is now learning. Pray we learn it quickly. Another, Eamon says, it's clear that the radical left are still in charge in RTE. We should welcome the fact that dictator was removed. We should now be looking for democratic elections to hold freely and openly. Liz, you were looking actually at a piece because actually some of the online response has been quite good. But I think that Idris Kaloun had a great piece in The Atlantic trying to make sense of the Venezuela attack. But it does raise that question. Well, what happens next? Are there going to be free and fair elections held? Who's going to run that, monitor it? We just don't know what the next day looks like.
I'd love to be celebrating the end of a dictatorship. That's not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is one individual extracted from a country by force against international law. We're not seeing any sort of post-conflict peace building or structuring or planning. That takes international cooperation and coordination. It takes goodwill building. It is extremely difficult. We know that very well here on this island. We've been trying to get it right for the last 30 plus years. There was some really good kind of analysis coming out overnight, including, in The Atlantic, it was another piece, it was Graham Wood's piece, comparing it to the Noriega arrest in 1989. And just that, you know, there was an opposition in exile, a kind of fully functioning, you know, recognized internationally opposition that was in exile, that was publicly kind of asking for this, who was prepared and ready to go in. There were also international treaties around the Panama Canal. There was the murder of an American kind of soldier on the ground. Like, there will be a lot of comparisons to Noriega, but in a way, each time that we have these slippery, well, the ends justify the means arguments around the erosion of international law, it makes the next erosion easier and easier. So in a way, Noriega made Maduro easier to happen. I completely get where commenters are coming from around, well, the dictator's gone, ends justify the means. No, it doesn't. Like, the international order matters. You know, whether or not there is another Maduro, whether or not there's another step, which is getting closer and closer to international disorder, this is a threat. It's, you know, like Trump did it with the tariffs. He had one or two kind of, you know, big set pieces, and then all of a sudden we're finding other countries, you know, getting into line. You know, I was watching the president of France, you know, saying this very vague, oh, well, it's good he's gone, let's wait and see. The EU, everything is couched. Everybody is afraid because of this kind of exertion of power to really be pushing back and to be standing up. I mean, it's just this erosion, and we're heading in a very, very negative.
Is that the case,
Pat
Leahy? Is everybody kind of gently?
Well, I mean, as I said earlier, I think a lot of that is because of the situation in Ukraine, but it's also because of... they don't want to antagonize Trump for other reasons, as well as having to do with Ukraine. And, you know, nobody feels this sort of tightrope between that you have to walk with the Trump administration more so than Ireland. I mean, I was in the Oval Office last year covering Micheál Martin's visit, and, you know, all that tension was written on the face on his face and that of his advisors. And if you cast your mind back to that, and presumably, you know, a similar debate will take place this year in advance of the Taoiseach's trip to Washington. But if you remember,
Pat,
back
just
last year,
because you're on the topic, one of our listeners says, can you ask the panel about the Irish triple lock? Should we still have a big power video on our national defence? US action proves time for change is now.
I mean, I kind of think...
An easy one, just before we go to...
Yeah, I was writing about this a little bit over Christmas in the Irish Times. I think,
like when you look at the changes that have happened in the world and how the reality of international relations has been transformed, principally by Trump, but also by the invasion of Ukraine. When you look at the threats that face Europe and the extent to which Europe is scrambling to face those threats in the East by rapid rearmament, I mean, it kind of makes the debate over the triple lock kind of ridiculous.
Yeah. You're not in cabinet now. So
no, but we have to speak freely. I know that the defence bill will be part of the legislative schedule this year, which is planning to remove the triple lock. So I think just to go to your point on it, one of the things I just wanted to mention briefly is around the Security Council, because I believe there's a meeting next Monday. It'll be interesting to see whether there'll be sanctions or resolutions for this act. Now, I know whether the allies or Venezuelans' allies will take part in that remains to be seen, but it'll be interesting.
Scott, just before I go to the break, can I just ask you about Iran? There was an interesting editorial, perhaps maybe an unsurprising one, or a surprising one rather, in the Telegraph, kind of pointing to the risks and the great gamble for Trump on Venezuela, but including that broader geopolitical risk, especially in circumstances where he's saying that he will go in to help protesters there if he wants to.
Yeah, there's a double risk. First, there's a risk in terms of the precedent set before you get to Iran, that if China wanted to go in and lift the president of Taiwan and saying, look, you're a traitor because you don't recognize one China, they've just been handed the pretext by Trump. Putin's attempts to assassinate Zelensky, although they've been successful, if he ever was successful, he could use the pretext, well, he was a threat to greater Russia, therefore it. But then there's the other risk here, which is, okay, how far do you go in terms of interventions? Very good former student of mine who writes for a UK paper, has a piece today, Deepa Parent, has been talking to Iranians about this. And they're saying from inside, look, we see no hope whatsoever. We have nothing to lose by going onto the streets. But they face that risk of getting shot, getting detained. The issue here is that Trump's locked and loaded comment, which is we will come in and we'll use military force, immediately undercuts the legitimacy of those protests. Because what the regime's line is from the supreme leader down is these aren't protesters that are genuine Iranians who are concerned about their country. They're foreign directed from the U.S. and from Israel. So again, with Iran, while supporting those protesters in terms of what they're seeking and so on, you have to be very careful to make sure that change is coming from within the country and that you're not imposing it from without, whether that's in Iran or in the other case we're discussing, Venezuela.
Okay, well, it's just coming up to 11:30, so we'll take a quick break. Very welcome back. With me in studio are Josefa Madigan, Scott Lucas, Liz Carlin and Pat Leahy. Josefa, I might just go, I think this is this your first media turnout since you left cabinet? Been quiet for a little while.
Yeah, over a year actually. Yeah. I wasn't sitting on my laurels.
No. What have you been up to since?
Well, I did a diploma in corporate governance. I think I got my one and only distinction in it actually. So I was delighted about that. And I'm mediating as well. So I've written a book on mediation many years ago. So I've gone back to that.
What were the reasons why you left government?
I think professional and personal. It's no secret I went through a divorce, which I know plenty of people do. But I think that's a time when you evaluate where you are in your life. I had been in politics 10 years. I was about 8 years a minister. Incredible privilege. Really enjoyed it. But I wasn't to know that other people would also believe in Fine Gael around the same time.
And not just some.
Some very high-profile, quite a significant exit.
Is there something about political life that is, because people were leaving in their 40s and 50s, when they had that kind of time, energy and the exodus was quite marked?
Yeah, when I look back to people like Enda Kenny, and I served under him, incredible politician. He was 40 years in the Dáil. Brendan Howland, people like that. I personally think those days are gone. It's such an incredibly relentless job. That's not to say it's not fulfilling. But, and if I start complaining now about 100-hour weeks, the taxpayer pays for that. But that is what it demands, particularly with social media, you've got your constituency, you've got your ministry, you've got your party. It's just all consuming. And there's very little manoeuvre for anything else in your life if you're going to try and do it properly. And even when you try and do it properly, you still don't always get it right. But you do your best by your own principles.
Did you find it was becoming a much more unforgiving culture? Like you mentioned social media. Were you subjected, as other colleagues right across the political spectrum, have you subjected to abuse? Was that a factor?
Yeah, no, it wasn't a factor for me leaving, but absolutely. Mainstream too, I have to say. You know, I think that's important to say. They're not always kind in the main. And people have their personal views about you, perhaps your background, and you're tarred in a certain way when you're not like that at all. And that's quite difficult. But it's not the reason I left. I mean, it was a bit counterintuitive for me in the sense that Dublin Town was having an extra seat. Fox Rock, where my mother still lives, was coming back into the constituency. But it wasn't about winning the election. It was about the next 5 years, and I just decided it was the time in my life to make a change and get more of a work-life balance.
Well, you are as qualified, if not more qualified, than any on the panel to talk about the political year ahead. And don't hold back. But a number, and I know you picked out Claire Scott's piece in the Sunday Times, which was Martin and Harris face a tricky balancing act in the year ahead, not least with the two by-elections. A lot of pressure on the main coalition leaders.
Yeah, I mean, by-elections are notoriously difficult to win when you're in government. Obviously, I'd like to see Sean Kine in Galway West, and I'd like to see Ray McAdam in Dublin Central. I have to.
You haven't quite lost it.
You've
got the mentions.
I got those mentions.
She will now have to mention all the other candidates.
Yeah. Just get them quick.
So obviously, just as as a form of Fine Gael, I'm going to say that. But they are notoriously difficult. That there will be some excellent candidates. So we'll see how that goes. I think. This, or 2025, 2025 was a tough year for the coalition overall. But we have to bear in mind that a lot of cabinet ministers now, particularly on the Fine Gael side, but also the Fianna Fáil side, are new in cabinet. So, you know, Jennifer, Peter, Martin, Patrick, they're all new to cabinet. And it takes a year really to get to know your brief and read inside your brief. There's an awful lot in it. So I'm hoping that this year that'll sort of pan out, you know, a little bit better, and people will be.
Pat Leahy, Shane Ross has an entertaining piece, as always, in the Sunday Independent. Martin's fortunes will soon change if his Fianna Fáil foes join forces.
Yes, from Micheál Martin's point of view, some gloomy prognostications in Shane Ross's piece. I think perhaps he slightly overdoes it. If it's one thing that we know from the last 2 months in Fianna Fáil, it's that at present the rebels don't either have the numbers or the inclination to put down a motion of no confidence. And I suspect that barring any political earthquakes in the first couple of months of the year, what you will see is Micheál Martin consolidate his position rather than further endanger it. The one big banana skin, I suppose, as Josepha says, is the by-elections. Now, they have to take place, I think, before the middle of May or so. So I would expect the writs to be moved in the Dáil in April and the elections to take place in May. And it's very difficult to see. Now, you know, we've seen over the weekend how quickly events can move. But it's very difficult to see any political context in which the outcome looks in any way favourable for the for either of the government parties. So I think that is a danger for them. Having said that, at that point, Fianna Fáil is running up to the 100th anniversary of its founding. It's also just in the run into the beginning of the European presidency on the 1st of July. So I'm not sure really that you could see, everything is possible, but I'm not sure it's likely that you see a post by-election heave against Micheál Martin. What is possible, I think, is that poor results in those elections. And for instance, if there was to be a run of poor opinion poll results up until then, that it becomes more or less settled wisdom and settled policy in Fianna Fáil that once the presidency, EU presidency, is finished at the end of this year, that change will be on the cards then.
Can I ask you, Liz Carlin, Claire Scott was very busy this weekend, a lot of bylines in the Sunday Times, but she does an interview with Sinn Féin leader Mary Lou McDonald, and the title is Police Need to Cop On Over Trans Issue. But arguably, the more substantive part of that piece was her analysis around the by-elections and how are the left going to align or make each other transfer friendly.
Yeah, it's a good piece. You know, it's kind of a Mary Lou positioning herself for Taoiseach piece. If you kind of read behind the lines, you know, she's talking about my leadership style is thoughtful but assertive. You know, while ostensibly
she says modestly
while ostensibly talking about Sinn Féin having spent the last 2 years rethinking, you know, where it stands around kind of gender affirming care and gender identity issues. But she does then get into this question of the by-election, and you know, Sinn Féin were out straight away saying no, we're running our own candidates, we're not doing any sort of pact. But she is talking a lot about kind of vote left, transfer left pacts, and trying to figure out policy, kind of shared policy platforms with the other opposition on key social issues, she says, and cooperation. And I think you know, this is going to be the kind of make or break for the left for this year. Like, you know, the Irish left isn't unique in kind of tearing itself apart over like the tyranny of small differences, and it tends to be, you know, on those sort of social kind of out competing each other. And we saw a bit of this, I feel like, over the kind of Christmas break, a little bit before, the left, the other left party starting to kind of attack Sinn Féin, in particular around its sort of softening immigration. You know, like, it's trying to figure out how does it balance this, you know, like the left sort of fractured coalition in a lot of other countries between the working class kind of voter base and a more kind of liberal lefty middle class kind of voter base, which the left has gotten wrong in so many other countries and lost ground to the
I think it'll be one of the trends to watch this year is how the left cooperates. And I think there's two aspects to that. Clearly, migration is one aspect of policy cooperation that they're going to have difficulty with. But I look at it at another way. I look at it like, how are the parties going to cooperate, both in campaigning and in parliamentary terms? But the other way, which will be interesting, I think, is how do voters take that? So when you look then at the results of the by-elections, you know, what, to what extent are you seeing greater transfer patterns between the left-wing parties? Now, by-election results are almost over-analysed, but it will be interesting nonetheless to see how, not just how the politicians manage a left cooperation, but how the voters react to it.
And where does the left end up in terms of, you know, there's a lot of pressure in the international left to be kind of rethinking liberal stances, to be figuring out how do we deal with this enormous pressure that we have from the far right, who are taking kind of left wing votes by taking some of these, you know, blaming the vulnerable kind of approaches. My sense from reading this article is that where Sinn Féin are heading, at least on kind of gender identity issues, is one of taking a political leadership stance that is progressive, which is good.
I think
where they end up on migration, we have to wait and see.
Well, I mean, Mary Lou, I think, Deputy McDonald, I should say, had an article, I think, in the Irish Times during the week around immigration and wanting it to be rules based, which is exactly which is in the programme for government. So she's not saying anything different than what we're not saying, or what my former party weren't saying. But just in terms of the by-election, I think it's very dangerous for the left to mistake a presidential election for a by-election, or indeed a general election or a European election or a local election. They're all very different beasts. And because they obviously have this sense of pride, if you like, in the fact that President Connolly was elected. I think it would be very dangerous for them to think that that may apply in a by-election.
Yeah, that it might transfer easily.
Them coming together in that sense.
Scott Lucas, can I ask you about, there's a piece I think by Declan Lynch in the Sunday Independent, which you spotted, Bannon knows we can't resist a bout of nationalism. And this is the reference to Steve Bannon, I suppose, trying to see that, will we have an Irish MAGA movement that will evolve and perhaps maybe even see people elected on those fronts?
Well, certainly this is a serious threat, not just because of Steve Bannon, but because of many people in the Trump camp. The national security strategy we referenced earlier says effectively that the U.S. no longer wants to work with the EU. They want to undermine it. They don't want to work with European governments. They want to promote hard right governments. They don't use this exact phrase, but they actually want to promote white nationalist parties. Now, Steve Bannon has been pushing for that even before he went into the Trump administration in its first term. He did it when he was in the administration. He continues to do it. Now it's to the point where, before we get to Ireland, you have got people like J.D. Vance who are openly promoting AFD, the hard right party, some would say neo-Nazi party in Germany. Vance would like to promote the national rally in France. In Ireland, Steve Bannon happens to be of Irish ancestry. I don't think he actually has that much knowledge of what's happening in Ireland, but he's looking at what they're doing in the UK in terms of promoting the Reform Party and saying, let's use those same dangerous, meaningless tropes around the threats of those who are different colors, different religions. And beyond this, it's gotten to the point where names are being thrown around of certain Irish figures, and I will not name them here, but who Bannon could ally with to try to make this move. Because, of course, the big thing in Ireland is we still do not have that type of hard right party that you have on the European continent.
Well, Liz Carlin, do we comfort ourselves that we don't have that yet? Or is, you know, the point that Declan Lynch is making is that we can't afford to kind of sit back, that risk of the development of a hard right party or movement is entirely possible?
So there's been a lag between political discourse online and the actual results of an election and the actual kind of voting behaviour of people, probably about 3 or 4 years. I mean, Pat, I think we've been in debates over the years as to whether or not there was a kind of far right in Ireland, and, you know, figures who have 20,000 followers online get like 100 votes or whatever. But it has been seeping in, and there have been ways that far right figures have been able to shape discourse. And I think that is where, if you look at the UK, you know, the Brexit Party, whatever they're called, UKIP, never had to actually get more than one or two people elected at a time in order to shape the entire course of British history, right, by getting Brexit to happen. And I think that's the thing that we need to be looking at here, because we're seeing the UK Labour government make the exact same mistakes of thinking that it can outflank the far right by coming up with these really quite regressive, harmful kind of policies and positions. And it doesn't work, because all that you're doing is you're being a light version of the thing that people say that they want, and you're not actually offering an alternative. And that's where I think in this country we need to be looking ahead and planning, is what's our positive alternative vision to this kind of dystopia which is being presented by others, and how do we push that rather than, you know, trying to be a diet version of the dystopia.
Yeah. I mean, on a wider point, I've always had a concern in Ireland that there is, even though we like to be the Cead Míle Fáilte perception as a country, that we have an unconscious bias towards otherness and towards immigrants and towards people of different colour, of different creed. I mean, you only get off the tube in London and there's a kaleidoscope of different types of people. We don't have that here in this country as yet. And I think that's a lacuna. I think it's a concern, because it's exactly in that type of climate that Scott alludes to and Liz, that a far-right movement could spring up in the absence of simply being used to seeing otherness and different types of people around us. And most of us have grown up in a society. Now, it is changing.
It's changing.
And it has changed significantly, which is a good thing.
Well, can I ask you, Pat Leahy, though, that, you know, there used to be kind of quite a separate debate where housing was discussed here and migration was discussed here, and the two tended not to get aligned. And now, obviously, the political dialogue has changed here, not least with recent comments by Simon Harris, where you are directly linking those issues. And do you think that's because the public are pushing politics in that direction, or do they feel as if they need to step in where other parties or individuals might inflate that?
Yeah, so I think one of the ways that Irish politics works and has always worked is that the parties of the centre are very sensitive to movement at the edges. And so 2 years ago, government was very, very careful not to link those two issues of housing and migration. And in fact, government politicians didn't like talking about migration at all. But despite the fact that there was no elite discourse about it, if you like, there was a political debate about it. And we were seeing it in polls all the time where people were naming immigration as one of their chief concerns. But it wasn't really registering at the level of government versus opposition debate at all. That has changed now. And I think what has happened is that process that I alluded to earlier, which is one of the ways Irish politics works, which is that the big parties of the centre, they feel how the wind is blowing with regard to the public's political views, and they edge that way. And that is, I think, part of the reason. It's not the only reason, but it's part of the reason why you haven't had that big populist anti-immigration party that you see all over Europe. And there's some respects in which Ireland is different to Europe, but not all
Scott
that
Lucas,
many.
Is that a not yet?
I think there's two risks I see. And again, I still can, I'll always be a blow-in, but it's been 2 years since I came over here. And I see two risks in particular. The first is this conflation of immigration with these core issues about housing, transport, education, where instead of dealing with those issues on their merits, housing, transport, education, healthcare, it is too easy to say, well, let's just go and look and blame immigrants for this. And I think there's a danger in what Simon Harris did this week. You know, look, I'm an immigrant. I bought one of your houses. I love it here. I didn't cause your housing crisis by taking one of your houses. You have a housing issue that existed before the rise in immigration.
Can I just clarify, I'm not in government anymore, but I will defend the Taoiseach, because from my interpretation of what he said, the very first thing he said was that immigration is a good thing.
Fair enough.
And, you know, that's important to say. And I do think you're right. There can be a conflating of issues. I think he was just being factual and measured in what he said. What he effectively said was that a few years ago, we had about 3,000 immigrants. Now we're about 18,000 to 20,000.
No, that's one specific category of immigrants.
Let me finish. Yeah. But because, no, I agree.
Which people pay an awful lot of attention to.
Even though international protection, and I totally agree with that. But you know, there's a lot of work being done in terms of deportation orders and all of this sort of thing. But we need immigration in this country in terms of frontline services and all of those.
But rhetoric matters, right? The way that we talk about this, the way that we talk about people, the way that we talk about Irishness, about who we are, matters hugely. And you know, there is very significant international research that looks into this that says when parties of the centre, I know you said that, you know, when parties of the centre, if they kind of shift, then maybe we can neuter some of these far right instincts. Frankly, it's been Sinn Féin for a long time that has captured that vote by being aggressively progressive while also representing communities who have suffered from government failure, which could be easily blamed on outsiders.
But when
mainstream parties adopt the narrative and the language, and that is a bit of what Simon Harris has done, whether he did it willingly or not, when they adopt some of those narratives, when they're using that same language, it just legitimizes those far-right actors. It doesn't challenge them. It doesn't offer an alternative. It just offers a very light version of it.
The opposition,
and then people want the hard stuff.
Coming out and saying that, and the opposition are saying, you know, the systems can't handle it. And yet at the same time, they're saying, you know, we're taking too many or we're taking too little. So, you know, they can say one thing, but actually mean the other. And, you know, so there, I know what you're saying about populism, but they could be just as populist.
A question just before we go to the break, because as well as people like Scott and high tech workers, you spotted a piece in the Business Post where divorcees are actually not quite driving up. Well, they are. They're driving an upsurge in solo first-time buyers because they're treated as first-time buyers.
They are. Yeah. And, you know, like in the last, around in the 2022 census, there was something like about 246,000 people who identified as divorced and separated. And, you know, I think it's a fantastic thing for them that under this fresh start clause in the central bank's framework, borrowers who are divorced or separated may be considered first-time buyers. And that's a great thing, I think, for them to know. And it's good that it's highlighted here in the Business Post.
Yeah. Another little pressure on the housing crisis.
So it's the divorcees are leading to the housing shortage.
I'm
surrounded by divorcees and immigrants here, tech workers over here.
Don't raise us now.
And on that, we'll take a very quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Very welcome back. With me, Josepha Madigan, Scott Lucas, Liz Carlin and Pat Leahy. Liz, I don't know if it is a tech lash or a backlash, but the state's new digital ID plans are coming under a bit of pressure today. I think you spotted Wayne O'Connor's piece. State's new digital ID plan will be illegal.
Yeah, there's a lot of pushback against the government is looking at plans of having basically a form of digital ID so that if you want to access online services, there's a way for you verifying your kind of your age, your identity, your name. There's a few pieces in the paper about it and quite a bit of pushback from rights experts, I think.
And Eilidh O'Hanlon, I think, was in the Sunday Independent, exactly. Was also pushing back. Sorry, Simon, but we should keep our right to remain in the shadows online. Pat Leahy, is there a risk that in kind of trying to cure one wrong, you know, trying to protect children, etc., online, that it has, you know, the solution or the cure is even worse? Like, I mean, where's the pushback kind of coming from? You're a parent.
Yeah, but
do you want these?
Sometimes you have to choose between one thing and another. And you're right, there's a couple of pieces. And the one that Liz mentioned earlier there, it's TJ McIntyre, who's, you know, one of the country's foremost experts on this sort of thing. And he's saying in the Sunday Independent that he says this is going to be an expensive national embarrassment, which, I mean, it would be a brave prediction to say that that's not going to come true. Eilidh O'Hanlon, again writing in the Sunday Independent, talks about this as a retrograde. This the plan, which she says would basically end internet anonymity. And she views that as being a retrograde step, and she instances, you know, various examples of where people might have good reason to seek anonymity. But sometimes you have to choose between anonymity for everybody and anonymity for nobody. And she makes the point, you know, that Simon Harris had, while talking about this over Christmas, said, you know, Simon Harris said, you have people, they can just register themselves as Paddy123 and go on to attack people online, threaten them, people online. He says, you know, that's not right. I tend to agree with him, actually.
But Liz, but this isn't new. This is called the balancing of rights. It's been the foundation of kind of human rights discourse and philosophy for as long as we've ever, you know, as long as people have existed. But, you know, and there's a quote here that's attributed to Minister Patrick O'Donovan saying, no other right trumps the right of a child to be protected. And that's actually not true. Like, you know, human rights is about balancing all sorts of different rights and figuring out ways of protecting people. And, you know, whether it's this thing about, like, you know, if you want to watch a TikTok video that somebody sent you on the lads WhatsApp group, suddenly you have to hand over all of your passport details, right? or if we're looking at, you know, this kind of ban on children accessing social media, which they can easily get around. It's all a sign of system failure, of a failure to say, do you know what, X or Twitter or whatever, you shouldn't be allowed some guy to set up a million accounts and abuse people. And, you know, I've had death threats online. I'm sure lots of people have had all sorts of, you know, stuff thrown at them online. It's the platforms who are failing. And if we're saying, OK, well, actually, that's too hard, instead, we're going to
harvest the passport identification of everybody in the country who wants to go on the internet, store that who knows where, and these things are notoriously leaky. And, you know, you can say, well, if you've got nothing to hide, you shouldn't worry about this. Everyone has something to hide from someone. It could be your parent, it could be your boss, it could be your abusive spouse. It could also be the US, who are currently looking at changing their visa rules, so they need 5 years of all of your social media accounts. Everybody has something to hide from somebody.
It's naming all your family, your dependents, everything.
Yeah, I mean, it was not necessarily passports, but I mean, I have to say, I think that's, with respect, negativity on both your parts, because I actually think this is an EU matter anyway. Like there's already plans to harmonise the age of the 16. So, I mean, it's non-legislative at the moment, but it will probably become a regulation because the political will is there for that to happen. I personally think it's a really good thing. I think that the one in Ireland is going to be based on mygov.ie, which has security measures and there has to be data protection. I mean, when you're talking about experts, Dr. McIntyre, again, with respect to him, the department, and I was in the same department as Patrick O'Donovan, and I commend him for bringing this in. They have their own experts as well who will look at all of this. Like, there will always be people who will say yay or nay to any sort of proposal.
They haven't been great at regulating thus far.
But remember, above all, it's a pilot. It's not being transferred. And it's going to happen across the EU anyway.
Liz is right, of course, that there's a balance of rights to be found. But it's also about balancing rights and responsibilities. Mm. The responsibilities of the platforms to keep people, including, but not exclusively limited to children,
focusing on regulating people because of an abject failure to regulate
the platforms. Well, I think the least sympathy today will be for the OnlyFans creators, who the Sunday Times report have learned that the taxman is watching them. But I'm afraid that is all we have time for today. My thanks to Josepha Madigan, Scott Lucas, Liz Carolyn and Pat Leahy. Just after 12, we'll cross over to the newsroom.